Next week, we have Ken Chai Wen from MIT, who will be talking about the emergence of gauge fields, photons, gravitons, and everything else from condensed matter systems. That's for me. Okay, for me, let me know. And today, we have Senator Sue, who will tell us what to do with all those gauge fields and other particles once they emerge, and she's going to normalize them. Vincent is a mathematical quantum field theorist, among other things. He spent his career mostly in Paris, very fortunate. He spent some time in Princeton, which is a lifetime ago where we met, and haven't seen each other since. He was then in the CNRS in Paris, and then roughly when it opened, I think, moved to Orsay, where he's professor of physics, and he's going to give us a modern overview of normalization. And Vincent is here all this week and very happy to discuss with people.
Thanks, Yuli, for this introduction, and let me thank the Perimeter Institute for this invitation. I felt this is my first visit here, but I felt at home arriving here, so I hope this will not be the last. And I will talk about, an overview of renormalization. So I apologize for those of you who are experts on this field in the audience. I will try to make the core ideas accessible. And before I start, let me indulge in just a word which is completely extra. So let's try to do renormalization. So renormalization is a subject in ordinary quantum field theory, but I will also, in the second part of this lecture, talk about non-commutative quantum field theory and non-commutative renormalization to see what are the differences which arise when you try to adapt these ideas to a non-commutative world. And what I would like to review is work done partly at Vienna, at Orsay, and by related people. And these are people who worked on the renormalization in recent years of non-commutative quantum field theory. And it's only at the end that I will perhaps say some words about the possible links of these ideas with the problem of adapting back to quantum gravity, which is much more speculative yet. So let me say, what is quantum field theory in my point of view? Well, we have many possibilities about what is quantum field theory that you read in the textbooks. Okay, you could read it's about quantum mechanics and special relativity put together. Is it about functional integrals? Is it about Feynman diagrams? Is it about axioms and so on? We could quarrel for a while about what is really fundamental at the core of field theory. I think one of the most important motor in field theory was renormalization from the start. This was the main difficulty, and it has ever pushed the formalism forward since that time. And in quantum gravity, I have a question, which is quantum gravity a quantum field theory? It's perhaps a bit a provocative question, but let me ask it this way. And is it renormalizable? And the typical answer, the traditional answer to these questions is no in both cases. But I would like to review perhaps the questions with a fresh eye. Okay, and we have many approaches, as you know, currently in competition about the problem of what is quantum gravity. You have string theory, you have loop gravity, which is especially represented here. You have non-commutative geometry, and so on. And, we have to try perhaps to understand from all these perspectives, look at these questions. And I think non-commutative renormalization is going to give us perhaps an inspiration. That's what I will try to propose. So perhaps at a more abstract level, I would like to take the point of view that, in fact, among the different possibilities, axioms, functional integrals, graphs, or so on, I would like to say that for me, after I wouldn't have said that initially, because I started my career with one proponent of axiomatic field theory, Professor Whiteman. But I have tended to develop the idea that, okay, Feynman graphs, and in fact, more particularly what is called technically a parametric representation of Feynman graphs, is closest to the idea of making the quantum field theories as much as possible independent of a space-time formalism. Why? Because the Feynman graph is an abstract graph, and a graph doesn't live on a particular space-time. It's an abstract finite structure. So, okay. So, an intermediate step in the direction of making quantum field theory a bit less dependent on our intuition on ordinary space-time is perhaps to consider it either on curved backgrounds, that has a longer story, or on non-commutative backgrounds. This is called non-commutative field theory. And in 2004, there was a first example of how to renormalize such a non-commutative field theory, quantum field theory called the Gross and Vulkanar model, and I will come back on it. And I think that's, that will help us understand what is the most fundamental in quantum field theory. Another thing I wanted to say is that a key idea in the computation of field theory is to, why are Feynman graphs so useful? Because they automatize a key computation in quantum field theory, which is the computation of connected quantities. And, a Feynman graph is too much information for knowing that a thing is connected. In order to connect points, you don't need to know graphs which have lines which might make loops. You can, the essential piece of information would be a tree in order to connect points. And trees and forests appear naturally in classical mechanics. But one of the main differences of quantum field theory with classical mechanics is that you have backwards return in time somehow, and you have loops. And these loops are associated with the difficulties of quantum field theory and with the presence of infinities. So one of the main questions is perhaps to say, how could we make quantum field theory closer to classical mechanics that is based on trees and forests rather than on graphs? And in fact, trees and forests appear everywhere in quantum field theory and in renormalization theory. For instance, in renormalization theory, technically it's based on devices which are based on trees and forests. The trees and forests also appear in this parametric representation of Feynman amplitude, which are the most abstract way of representing quantities in field theory. They occur in my particular field of expertise, which is called constructive field theory, in which you try to resum the ordinary perturbative expansion. And I will perhaps say some words about this at the end of the talk. And especially if there are questions, I will be happy to talk more about constructive field theory. So I would like to say that non-commutative field theory leads to new variations on this theme. There are, there is a new point of view on the renormalization group. There are new polynomials. There are new Hopf algebra, new constructive expansions, and even a new kind of trees. So that was that is one of the 10. And I expect that in quantum gravity, there will be combinatoric tools that will be even more complicated variations on this 10. So my own sort of tentative answer to what is a quantum field theory for me, in the widest possible sense, is a kind of generating function for a certain weighted species in the sense of combinatorics. That is, you have finite structures, and you would like to sum them with weights. And this may perhaps look a bit naive compared to the usual functional integral formalism for quantum field theory, but I would say perhaps it's more basic. We will have to do. However, we'll have to see. However, some of the weights that we might meet in this theory indexed by finite structures may be given by divergent integrals. And also, you could have a difficulty in summing the series itself. So when you have a series, you may have an expression for finite coefficients that is infinity term by term. And this series, this sum, could also be infinity. So this is two different kinds of infinities that have to be distinguished. Or if, for instance, the series is a power series, and if it diverges no matter how small lambda is, this is called a series with zero radius of convergence in mathematics, and you don't know very well what is the meaning behind this series. So divergent integrals is a blue thing, and zero radius of convergence is a yellow thing. And the renormalization theory usually addresses the first problem. Roughly speaking, the solution to the first problem, that constants may be naively infinite in quantum field theory, is to exchange this infinity for a movement with scale of some of the parameters of the theory. And I will explain that a little bit more. So constant may move with scale and flow or into into fixed points. And this modern point of view on renormalization was introduced by Ken Wilson. Now, the constructive field theory addresses the second problem, which in my view shouldn't be overlooked, is as important as the first. And essentially, the solution, in red, is to replace the species of graphs by a smaller species, which contains less terms, and that resums in a clever way the proliferation of terms that you see in quantum field theory. So essentially, I would say the core of constructive field theory is not to use Feynman graphs, but to use trees instead, which resum large categories of Feynman graphs. Because there are much less trees than graphs, then you have a much better chance to have combined the fig in something which converges. So we should keep in mind these two things when we are going to talk about non-commutative field theory. If you want to interrupt, please don't hesitate to interrupt me. So now, what is renormalization? So I said renormalization has to do with a change on the scale. Well, okay, so it's a very general framework to see how to study how physical system changes when you change the scale of observation. But of course, we may be open to a kind of not completely trivial notion of scale. Especially, we are going to meet a notion of scale in non-commutative field theory, which is not exactly the trivial one. But let's just first concentrate on the traditional way of doing in ordinary quantum field theory. So mathematically, it corresponds to say you should reshuffle the initial theory, which has divergent weights, into another theory which iterates a certain renormalization group map. And this theory, which at each step, it will involve only convergent weights. So let's say in combinatoric terms, it means that you want really to exhibit your initial species F as a composition of a certain map corresponding to the summation over a single scale. And then there is something nice, which is that we have usually methods in constructive theory which can give us a perfectly well-defined expression in the good cases for G, that is for quantum field theory restricted to a certain fixed scale of observation, let's say between 1 centimeter and 1 meter. If you make a particular scale of observation fixed, and you limit your theory to the degrees of freedom which live on that scale, then usually constructive theory can reshuffle, can solve quantum field theory, and it's no longer divergent. If you express the theory in terms no longer of Feynman graphs, but in terms of trees. But the problem is that usually you do get a series which is convergent, but only for small lambda, for instance. You get a finite radius of convergence for the trees. Well, this is typically because the number of trees at order n is in constant to the n. Is well known since Cayley and the 19th century mathematics. So there is then the problem to try to combine the two previous steps, namely summing a theory at a finite scale and then trying to let the couplings evolve with the scale. You try to combine the two previous steps in a consistent way, and that would be called multiscale constructive theory. And that would solve really quantum field theory. But there is a snag. Yes. Yes.
Can I go back? Because there's a lot in there. So let me just see if I understand. So
yes.
So I have a theory of graphs and weights,
yes,
finally assigned to graphs, and there, yes, are, mm-hmm, integrals associated with closed loops that I'm trying to deal with.
Yes. Probably you get something like that. And here, for instance, you may have a coupling to a certain order of the graph, and this is a weight. And this is given by some Feynman rules. Okay.
Right. And there are infinities inside the A's when there are closed loops.
Yeah, if you have no cutoffs, this may be infinite.
And so your view of what renormalization is somehow replace this by some of trees which are graphs with no closed loops.
No, this is constructive field theory. Constructive field theory, okay, there are two steps. You first replace, this is supposed to be the full field theory. Okay, you first say this is a too difficult problem. I will study a smaller problem which is field theory limited with scales, between 2 to the I and 2 to the I plus 1 in a GV, or I don't know what, in a certain scale. And this one, you can sum this. And these are not infinite. And constructive field theory tells you, instead of doing this, you should sum over trees, of the sum of graphs which are compatible in some sense with the tree, of amplitudes. But you should carefully do the packets here, because a graph has many trees, and the trees can be computed in many graphs. So this was not so easy, but that's what constructive theory does. Once you have obtained a finite radius of convergence of this for a scale, you still need to put all the scales together. That is what renormalization group does. Mm-hmm. And then comes the snack. Can I come to the snack? Not here. Yes, I come to the snack.
So can I ask?
Yes.
Even more basic question. By graph, you mean a diagram with trees and loops, or?
Yeah.
What's a forest?
Oh, forest is simpler than a tree. If you ask a mathematician what is simplest, is it a tree or a forest, he will tell you it's a forest. Why? Because a forest is an acyclic graph, and a tree is an acyclic connected graph. So you have more words to define the trees than the forest. So for a forest, but okay, if forest is just a collection of trees, if you like. Forests appear both as objects when you try to decompose the graph into connected pieces, and also in the process of renormalization itself. So in fact, trees play big roles both in the constructive step, in which you try to resum the graph, even at a fixed scale, this sum is divergent. But in the good cases, you can find a resummation which is uniquely associated to it, called, for instance, Borel resummation. You transform this into a smaller sum indexed by less terms and by packets of these terms. And if you are clever, these packets then will converge because you have combined them correctly. Here appear trees or forests. But you have another place where trees and forests appear, and that's one of the mystery of renormalization, that these things that can be combined together, is that when you look at the way coupling constants evolve, there is a structure called Zimmermann's forest, which is sort of a solution of the flow equation. This has to do with the following thing. In classical mechanics, when you look at the evolution of a classical system, the solution is deterministic. It is always given by the sum of the trees. Now, who was able to see a classical structure in quantum field theory? Wilson. He showed that the evolution of the scale of coupling constants is like a dynamical system. And therefore, there is no surprise that there are trees inside when we take it. But OK, this is perhaps a bit fast answer. OK. Can I come to the slide now? Or? OK. So the main slide that makes quantum field theory ill-defined, I have the extreme view that, I am a mathematical physicist, and for the moment, I don't know any non-trivial quantum field theory in four dimensions that is well-defined mathematically. I would like at least to see one in my life. So why is it that there is no good definition, neither of Young-Mills theory, nor of 544, nor of quantum electrodynamics, and so on? Well, it's because the following thing arises. It's because when you have tackled the first two problems, that is, you have computed constructively quantum field theory in the slice, and you have tried to iterate the renormalization group map, then typically the flow of the second operation goes out of the disk delivered by the first. In other words, you know that you can sum for a lambda which is small in a given slice. But when you want to pile up all the slices, typically the flow will go out either on the infrared or in the ultraviolet direction. So this phenomenon occurs typically for ordinary quantum field theory, either in the infrared or in the ultraviolet end of the renormalization group. And because, I will explain whose models for which it arises in the infrared, whose models for which it arises in the ultraviolet. But there is no good model for which it doesn't arise at all, except possibly for extremely special models. And this is somewhat frustrating. For instance, let us talk about the simplest model of quantum field theory is called the 544 model. And it has an action and a propagator. You don't need to know all this thing to follow what I'm going to say, except that propagators are quantities associated to lines in field theory and interaction to vertices. So graphs will be made of lines and vertices, and some weights will be associated to them. And there will be a kernel between these points for every propagator. And this propagator is, for instance, this heat kernel corresponding to the inverse of the Laplace plus square. And a Schwinger function is then a kind of a normalized vacuum, normalized the moment of this measure. But then you have perturbation theory. You can expand these functions as graphs, but you have the problem that amplitudes may be infinite because of the integrals which are written there, and sums here might be infinite. Okay, so these are the two sources of difficulty. Suppose that, let's try to say why in ordinary field theory, renormalization is possible at all. It relies on, I think renormalization is like a cooking recipe, and for a good, making a good cake, you need eggs, and you need butter, and you need milk, or I don't know, or fruit, or you need several. So I think in a good renormalization recipe, you need several ingredients. I see at least three main ingredients. You need to have understanding of what is scale in your problem. Well, in ordinary field theory, it's a bit naive, you will see. Scale is just whether a thing is big or small. But in non-commutative field theory, it will be different. So you need a notion of scale. You need a locality principle. And you need a power counting argument, which tells you that in certain cases, you will be able to reshuffle the divergences and to absorb them into a change of the parameters of the theory. And I will try to explain what are these three principles, these three ingredients in the commutative, in the ordinary quantum field theory case. So first of all, let us say the two first elements are quite universal. And it's the third one which depends on the details of the model. So in ordinary field theory, the scale is very simple. Scale is, you know, ordinary continuous world. You have a notion of scale by notion of distance. Small distances are small scales. Large distances are called the infrared. And at small distance, you have to explore with a lot of energy. At large distance, with small energy. So you have duality between ordinary scale in X and in momentum space. Okay. Now, the locality principle is extremely simple, and you can explain it to the man in the street. You can say, okay, the locality principle in quantum field theory is the following thing. When you see a small object from far away, it looks like a point. That's not difficult to understand. You can explain that to the man in the street. But we are going to see that the locality principle in non-commutative field theory, you cannot explain to the man in the street. It's more complicated and more sophisticated. And the power counting is just, okay, that is a bit more technical. Let me try to show you this by using the parametric representation of the propagator. When you have a representation of the propagator by a formula, a propagator is an inverse of an operator. And mathematicians usually like to tell you that what is important in an operator is a spectrum. And in order to analyze the spectrum, it's usually very convenient when the operator is positive to use this representation of an inverse. This was Schwinger trick, and this is an excellent trick. Then instead of cutting naively the spectrum of H, you might cut this range of integration, and you get a very nice setting of the propagator. And that gives you a very nice notion of scale, because notion of scale here will just be a kind of spectral notion for the Laplacian, in this kind of ordinary field. So you cut this integral by making a scale like that, and you have a scaling behavior then of the propagator in a slice, which tells you that it decreases when points get far away from each other with a certain typical spatial scale, and there is a prefactor in front. And here is a fixed integer, like 2 or 10, your favorite integer. And then, in this theory, you can say that higher and higher values of the scale index probe shorter and shorter distances. That's how you put scales into the problem. And now, the key problem for renormalization is to sum over these scales index for each line of the graph. And in this problem, some subgraphs play an essential role. They are the connected subgraphs whose internal lines all have higher scale index than all the external lines. So this is a bit complicated sentence. But I put it in red because for me it's really an essential story about renormalization. It's that if you like the system of Feynman graphs, it's a little bit like a sort of toy world in which you have a kind of property like Russian dolls, you know. When you open a Russian doll, there is a smaller doll inside. So in a graph, there can be a subgraph inside the graph. And those subgraphs who have internal lines with higher scale index than the external lines, they play a very special role because we are going to see they are the one who look like a point when you see them through the external legs, that is through the observation scales for the subgraph.
and they form the forest for the inclusion relation. So the locality principle is the following. It says that every high subgraph, it looks more and more local as the gap between the smallest internal and the largest external scale grows. So here I have a little drawing. So let me suppose this is a graph, okay, a graph of a 5-4 field. Let me suppose these are the external lines in blue, and the internal lines are in red. If the red scale is higher than the blue scale, it means the distance between these two points is very small compared to the pixel that you can analyze with this very low wave, very long wavelength. Okay? So for the blue observer, this looks like a point. He cannot distinguish the internal details of this structure. So he believes that this thing is a vertex. If he believes this thing is a vertex, what he does, he adds it to the initial coupling of the theory, and he gets what we call an effective coupling. That's the essence of why renormalization groups generate flows of the coupling. Okay. So power counting is now to look, depending on the dimension d, whether you can sum or not between the gap, over the gap between the lowest internal and highest external scale. Does it converge? Does it diverge? Okay. So you want to compare sort of the contribution of this thing to the constant contribution. So in doing that, you should not forget that there was a prefactor in front of the lines here, which was an m to the 2i. And you see, if you have a single local object, you have a single sum associated to its position. It's like a barycenter, if you like. But in the other graph, you have two sums. So the difference between two sums and one sum is one sum. If you have n sums inside and one sum at the arrival, the difference is n minus one sums. So you should count the weight of n minus one sums and then add all the prefactors of the line to get the power counting. And in the case of 5-4-4, for instance, you get the factor m2i per line and an m minus 4i per vertex, n minus one times. And therefore, you get a power counting, which happens to be only dependent on the number of external lines, because in the 5-4 theory, the number of lines is related to the number of vertices. So when this factor is strictly negative, the sum is convergent, and otherwise it diverges. Now, if it converges, it's not very important. I mean, the effect due to the higher scales do not affect very much the theory at lower scale. But if it diverges, you have to take it into account, and you have sort of to incorporate it in the flow. Okay. And now, I will speed up slightly. Now, what I would like to say is that in the case we have seen, 5-4-4 is renormalizable, for instance, and this kind of field theory is renormalizable in four dimensions, because only subgraphs with n equals 2 and 4 external leg diverge and give you effects that you have to take into account. That is, the high energy physics affects the low energy physics only through these effects. And these effects just change the value of the initial coupling of the theory. So a theory which is renormalizable is a theory, if you like, which satisfies a kind of scale, not scale invariance, but scale self-similarity, but with different couplings. So when scale change, the structure of the theory doesn't change, but the value of the parameters change. Okay. So that's what we call a renormalizable theory. And therefore, for instance, this theory is perturbatively renormalizable, but as we said, okay, there is this snag, which is that the flow after a while will go out of the domain of convergence that you may have through, for instance, constructive methods. And this is called by many names, but for instance, a generic name for that is lack of asymptotic freedom. But in fact, it was discovered by Landau and called first the Landau ghost in the case of the 5-4-4 theory or in the case of quantum electrodynamics. What happens is the following. If you like, for instance, to this graph, and you look at what it does, if you look at this graph, sorry for my English, and if you try to incorporate it into the flow, you see that if I is an index that goes into higher and higher scales, what is going to be the lower scale effective coupling? For instance, what is lambda I minus 1 compared to lambda I? Well, in 5-4 theory, at least in Euclidean space, you have a minus sign is in front of the interaction. So you should really look at the flow of minus lambda. And you see that what was the initial vertex is the vertex at scale I plus this radiative correction. But the problem is that this minus
gets squared and therefore gives you a plus sign. Therefore, if you work out this equation, you see that lambda is growing with I. And it's growing in a way, this classical dynamical system is a very simple flow in one dimension, and we know it diverges, and it even diverges in finite time. So after a while, you get out of the region that you can control with small coupling method. And that's why we cannot construct the 544 theory, and we don't know what is its real mathematical meaning. Okay, in the 60s, all known field theories suffered from this problem. But then, in the 70s, field theory and renormalization made a spectacular comeback, I would say. And, okay, I put a little, somewhat to the surprise of string theorists of the time. Don't be worried by this. So, what happened is that by introducing non-abelian gauge theory, that is some kind of non-commutativity in the theory, the theory was still shown renormalizable by Toft and Deltman, and it was shown to be asymptotically free, that is without any Landau ghost. And I don't know, but Frank Wilczek is here today, but perhaps not in this room. So that was done by David Gross, Politzer, and Wilczek. And they could use this idea to have a very successful theory of the strong interactions called the QCD theory. However, the counterpart of the lack of a Landau ghost means that the problem of growing of coupling still arises, but in the over direction of the flow of a very renormalization group. That is at very large scale. You get something called infrared slavery, which means that the theory creates bound states that you cannot analyze easily within perturbation theory. So that mathematically, you still have a problem of understanding what the theory would be without cutoffs. You could try to stop the renormalization group flow by a trick which is said to give mass to particles. But then the problem is that gauge theories don't like masses of particles, and this creates additional mathematical problems. So it's a bit of a problem. Now, one of the purpose of my talk is to tell you how all this is modified, for instance, in some models of non-commutative geometry. So non-commutative geometry is a mathematical, if you like, enlargement of ordinary geometry. Ordinary geometry may be described by, you know, the set of functions or observables, classical functions on a manifold, tell you about the geometry of that manifold. But their multiplication law is commutative. And if you think about the non-commutativity of quantum mechanics, you are led to the idea that why not try to extend this non-commutativity to space itself? So if space was quantized somehow, we could imagine that, for instance, there might be some new kind of Heisenberg relations, not only between X and PX, but also between X's itself. For instance, you might have, between two different coordinates, a constant commutator, like a generalization of the Planck's constant. But you see that in that case, this theta, or this parameter theta, would have dimension of meter squares, so it would define a fundamental length in the theory. Well, in quantum gravity, we might have a fundamental length in the world anyway, so why not imagine that some phenomena like that could occur? Then we could imagine that on such a world, what would the ordinary quantum field theory become? So for that, we have to generalize the ordinary product of function into a non-commutative product which is based on this relation, and which is called the Moyal product. So I will not enter too much into technical details, except to say that the product of two functions, f of x, f times g at point x, is equal to f of x times g of x. So it only depends on local data, the value of f and g at x. But the Moyal product is not like that. The Moyal product of f with g at the point x is a function of f at y and g at z, for such an integral superposition. So it's non-local. So non-locality is important because that will completely change the meaning of the locality principle in the corresponding quantum field theory. So the corresponding product is Trachsel, so you have some property like that. It means that actually if you write the analog with a star product of, for instance, an action, you will see that it will modify the vertex but not the propagator. So there are many ways, many technical tools to analyze this star product. One The simplest example of the non-commutative product is a product of matrices. So you can ask first, is there a way to map sort of this product into a matrix product? Not exactly, because in the strictest sense for mathematicians, matrices are finite. But somehow you would like to have an extension to sort of infinite matrices, and that is called the matrix base. There is a base for the functions from RD to C, for instance, in which the start product is essentially becomes a matrix product, but an infinite one. That is, if you expand phi of x into modes with respect to this basis f, m, n of x, just like imagine this as being a generalization of, for instance, Fourier modes, you have coefficients phi, m, n, which are the generalization of the Fourier coefficients, and then the star product of two functions of the basis is a delta of another one, and that means that the star product like that is, in fact, given by a law, which is exactly the law of multiplication of infinite matrix. So it looks like a matrix multiplication, except that these matrices are now infinite. So that's called the matrix base, and it's convenient to analyze star products of functions in this Moyal space. Integration becomes a trace of these infinite matrices. And then you can play the game of replacing the, okay, so in D equals 4, it means you would have a pair of integers, because you would have one pair of integers for each symplectic structure here. Look, this symplectic structure are a bit bizarre, because after all, R4 should be made of three dimensions of space and one of time. And here you see more a decomposition which looks like 2 plus 2. So this looks very different from what we would like to have. So we shouldn't perhaps take this model too seriously. But let's, for instance, for the moment, take it as a kind of mathematical game. Then what would be a quantum field theory on that? So there are some motivations, first of all, for quantum field theory on that space, although it may seem a bit bizarre at the beginning. It arises as an effective regime of both string theory and at least partly some different models arise as effective regime of some models in loop gravity. It is also a problem which can arise if you have a physical problem in a strong background field. For instance, the quantum Hall effect. You have a magnetic field which is strong and perpendicular to a surface in which you have charged particles, and it induces effects for which the best technical tool is this Moyal space, this Moyal product. Well, I think we can even say that a quark confinement, for a reason that maybe I explain later, is a problem that could be attacked with this technique. Okay. So there are also other people who are interested in non-commutative spaces for other reasons, as a kind of natural, at least partial reformulation of a standard model. But beware that for the moment, these people, like Alain Cohn and the people around him, they don't use usually Moyal spaces. They use more non-commutative, smaller spaces which corresponds to Kaluza-Klein compactification. So that's a different perspective. Still, it may have interesting contact points with the full R4 being non-commutative. And I'm going to try to push a bit to the completely controversial idea that non-commutativity of space-time could be a bit an alternative to a very popular current idea in theoretical physics that has dominated theoretical physics for 20 or 30 years, the idea of supersymmetry. But of course, I don't claim that supersymmetry exists or not. We are going to know, perhaps, with LHC. But I am claiming that perhaps some models may be consistent, for instance, quantum gravity without supersymmetry, which is a bit controversial. Okay, so the naive version of the 5-4 model, for instance, on Moyal space, would be to replace the ordinary products by star products. But because the star product is Trashian, it doesn't modify these two terms. It only modifies the blue one. And then, from the point of view of combinatorists, you can no longer really describe the perturbative contribution to that theory by Feynman graphs, but you have to use another category, which is called the category of ribbon graphs. And the sides of the ribbon are associated to indices in the matrix multiplication. So if you like, the ribbon graphs are a bit more complicated extension of the usual Feynman graphs. And they have also the same defect, namely they proliferate fast. Okay, here is a certain terminology on ribbon graphs. If you have a certain number of vertices, of lines, you have also a new notion of faces, which corresponds to following the ribbon borders. You have a notion of external lines, and you have a notion of genus, which is a completely new notion. So genus is given by Euler's relation. It's a combination between vertices, line, and faces. You also have a notion of external faces, the one which contain arriving external lines. And for instance, you have the following example. This is a ribbon graph. You see, it's a bit more complicated than a graph. The dotted lines are external legs, and the not dotted lines are the internal lines, for instance. So this subgraph has a certain number of external legs and of internal lines. So for instance, to get the number of internal lines, you just close by chirurgy all the external lines, and you get a simpler drawing like that. And then you count the number of vertices. You have three vertices because you have 1, 2, 3, okay? Which you also see here, 1, 2, 3. The number of internal lines, you have 1, 2, and 3. The number of faces is the number of circuits you have when you follow the ribbon borders. So you have one here and an external one here. So you have 2 faces. And the number of external legs, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then the genus is 0, because the genus is 1 minus V minus L plus F over 2. So V minus L is 0, plus F is plus 2 divided by 2 is 1, 1 minus 1 is 0. This is called a planar graph, or a graph which has no genus, a trivial genus. And for instance, this drawing, if you make surgery on the external legs, you get this simpler drawing, and then you can count. It has 2 vertices, 1, 2. It has 3 lines, 1, 2, and this is a single line. But it has now a single face, because when you follow starting there, okay, I'm trying to do this, you will have this. And you return to the same point. So you have only a single face. You have E equals 2, 1, 2. And you have a certain number of external faces here. It's a number of faces which receive some external legs. So because there is only one face and it receives external legs, EF is 1. But let me say what is the genus. The genus is 1 because, V minus L is 0 and F is 1. So 1 minus 1 half, sorry, what did happen? 2 minus, no, 1, sorry. Yeah, 2 minus 3 is minus 1 plus F plus 0, so G is 1. So. Okay, so now an interesting problem was discovered when analyzing the structure of divergences of this theory, which is that the planar graphs remain unchanged. They have the same value in the non-commutative and in the commutative world, but non-planar amplitudes create a new type of divergence, which is of the infrared type. So that's a bit bizarre. Well, I will not discuss this because I have not too much time. So. Eventually, if there are questions, I will explain this a little bit more. But it means that the ordinary 5-4 theory that I have described here is not renormalizable. You cannot absorb all infinities into a change of the parameters, and you don't understand very well where are the scales of this model. Okay, then the theory cannot be renormalized. So there was an interesting progress made in 2004 when Gross and Vulkenaar proposed to add a new term to this theory, which was inspired by a new symmetry between momentum and position. So that's bizarre, because a priori, big momentum is going to correspond to short distance. If there is a symmetry between short distance and short momentum, it would mean a kind of symmetry between what is large and small. So that's a kind of bizarre idea at first sight. But if you admit, the reason for which they found this is because this vertex is indeed curiously symmetric under this relationship. So they found if the vertex is like that, maybe like in a gauge theory, the vertex tells me that there is a symmetry in the theory, and I should implement also this theory on the quadratic part, which is there. And then you see that this term is exactly the dual of this. So if you have this, you should have this partner somehow under this symmetry. So although this breaks the usual translation invariance of the theory, they made this bold move, and they found that this theory is renormalizable. And what interests me in this statement is to explain you that it has a new notion of renormalization group, which is associated to this new notion of renormalizability. And I hope this might be an inspiration for perhaps even bolder steps concerning low-quality. So this result has now been proved through many independent methods. And we have now really pushed the theory to a good level of mathematical understanding. So yes.
Yes. What about the space-time perceptual cross trouble? Space.
Yes, in this theory, I am completely insensitive to time. I will, for instance, work in the Euclidean space, and I will not consider any preferred direction as time. So this may be perhaps weird.
Yeah, we should have to get into.
Yeah, so it could be called statistical quantum field theory, if you like. Okay, you could imagine Euclidean time as being, for instance, the kind of formalism that arises when you have a statistical model at equilibrium. So in that case, you don't have really time evolution because you're at equilibrium. And time becomes sort of imaginary, and then you can treat it as a space direction. But I agree that this is not a model in Minkowski space. For the moment, there is no time evolution there. So, okay, I will perhaps... my problem is in the remaining 10 minutes, I would like to give you an idea that the cooking recipe for renormalization, you know, the eggs and the milk and the fruits and so on, is entirely different now. And to do that, unfortunately, is a bit technical, so I nevertheless try to introduce it, but I will have to go a bit, maybe I will skip this. Okay. So in the metric space, there was a big feat. Gross and Vulkanar were able to compute actually the propagator of this theory with the harmonic term included, and is given by a very complicated expression. I won't detail this, but this is complicated. The only thing I can say is that in quantum gravity, there are expressions with integers of this kind which are even worse. But let's not look at this for a moment. So it's a nightmare, but not a nightmare as nightmarish as in quantum gravity. But okay. The only thing I want to know about this propagator is that there is a parameter omega, which corresponds to the harmonic potential, and there is a point, omega equals 1, in which this thing simplifies dramatically. It becomes this, 1 over n plus a constant. This is very simple. And there is a delta function which tell you that this propagator conserves line indices at omega equals 1. So technically, it's what mathematicians call an independent, non-identically distributed Gaussian measure. Because it's independent because M and N couple only to M and N. But it's not what the mathematician called identical distributed, because the covariance GMN does depend on M and N. It's not constant. So it's a class of matrix models which, from the mathematical point of view, is complicated. Okay. Called independent, non-identically distributed. But from this point of view, and from another basis representation, which is direct space, if you combine both, you are going to understand why the theory is non-normalizable and what are the new ingredients in the cooking recipe. So in direct space, you have a formula for the propagator, which tells you it's no longer the heat kernel, but something called in mathematics the Mayer kernel. But you can write exactly the Mayer kernel in mathematics because you can solve for this kernel. Of course, x squared and p squared no longer commute, but nevertheless, this can be computed, and it involves some hyperbolic trigonometric function like that, but it can be computed. And you have a part which looks a bit like the former heat kernel, but you have a new part which is the main center of the harmonic potential. So if you do that, you can still slice the theory with the slice analysis of this. But remember, for a harmonic oscillator, the spectrum of a harmonic oscillator does no longer correspond to small position or large position. Because p squared plus x squared can be large either if p is large or if x is large. So it's no longer the same spectrum and the same meaning of scale. Now, the Moyal vertex is just the trace of phi 4 in the metric space. And in X space, it is made of two parts. One, which tells you that X1 minus the four field, the seat at the four corner of the parallelogram. Why? Because there is this delta function which tells you that X3 minus X4 is parallel and equal to X1 minus X2 with minus sign. So X1, X2, X3, X4, this vector has to be minus this vector. Therefore, this thing has to be a parallelogram because of this vector. And now this thing is just the area of the thing. So it means the vertex is non-local and it oscillates. Okay, surprising. Now, what is the recipe for renormalization in this model? You have, again, three elements, and they are different. You have a new scale decomposition, you have a new locality principle, and you have a new power count. So in the remaining 5 minutes, I have to tell you what are these three new cooking elements. So the new scale decomposition means that the spectrum of this propagator is no longer based on the notion of is something small or big. It's more like a notion of is something either big or small, or is it middle size, I would say. That's a new notion of locality of scale decomposition in this problem. You can see also that the integers in this matrix space, they start from zero and they grow to infinity. It's not like when you have a logarithmic scale, you can have scale from minus infinity to plus infinity. Things are 2 to minus I is very small, 2 to plus I is very large. But there are no negative integers in this problem. So there is a kind of bottom, which is a middle size. And then you can grow either to small or large somehow. So maybe this means that we are the middle size of the universe, and either the very small or the very large escapes somehow our direct observation. Okay. The new locality principle is no longer that something which is small and seen from far away looks like a point. It's a thing which is more sophisticated. And I am going to show you what it is. Okay. So, well, as in the commutative case, these two elements are quite universal, but the third depends on the dimension and interaction. So you have a new evaluation of the propagator in the slice, which tells you that you have a both this thing, which is exactly like before, with this same factor, but this thing, which is new. And this has to do with this TH and co-TH functions. Okay. So as I said, a slice will correspond to a mixture of ultraviolet and infrared. Okay. And what is this new locality principle, which I like to call modality principle in this case? It's the following. Imagine that I have a high subgraph. But if I do again the drawing that I had just before, remember there were two red lines and four blue lines. And now the vertex is non-local, so the vertex is a parallelogram, and because I have two vertices, I have two parallelograms. Okay? And these parallelograms oscillate with a factor which is proportional to their area. So now suppose that this scale is higher than that one. I can no longer say that this is small compared to this, but say it is higher in the new sense of the scale that I have introduced. Because there is this previous factor here, which is like before, if I is very large, you see that X and Y are very close. So it means that in this drawing, compared to the scales of the blue lines, the red lines are very short. So what happens to this drawing when the red lines are very short? It pinches these two ends like that. And then you have these two parallelograms, gets almost equal there. Therefore, this vector, which was parallel to that, that one is almost equal to that, which was parallel to that one. By transitivity, this is almost parallel to that. And the sum of these two areas, miracle, is the area that you see between these four corners. So for the people who see it in the blue world, this looks like a vertex. And therefore, they treat it like a vertex of the initial theory. So that means that, again, their coupling constant has moved. But this is not a move that tells you that the small scales have been taken into account and created an effective theory at large scale. It's something new. Okay, so also this is new because of the following reason. If you take a graph which is not planar, this doesn't happen. Because the summation of area here, if you had faces which were sort of below, it will not give you the sum.
So it applies only to planar graphs with a single external face. And then the power counting is also new and depends on the genus. And when you have a genus which is not trivial, you see that the power counting improves. And that you can see in the matrix base at omega equals 1. OK, because essentially, in the matrix base, you have one index to pay per face. I will not do exactly the power counting, but just tell you that when you have less faces, you have less indices to pay, and therefore the graph is smaller. OK, so the non-commutative renormalizability, it again follows from a combination of arguments. The power counting tells us that only planar graphs with a single external face must be renormalized, but precisely they are the one which looks like the vertices of the initial theory by this new modality principle. So everything works. OK, now the bonus is the following, which was completely unexpected. It's that there is no Landau ghost in this theory. There is a new phenomenon which happens, which is in this theory, you have naturally an example of what is called in physics asymptotic safeness. That is, it's neither asymptotic freedom in the ultraviolet nor in the infrared. It means that there is only half a direction. And when you look at a theory with a coupling and you look at its flow, instead of diverging in this half direction, it converges to a fixed point. So that's a behavior that, for some reason, we might desire in some theories of quantum gravity. OK, so this phenomenon, OK, I don't want to talk about it, but if you have. This is because essentially you have one parameter more, and you get automatically by the renormalization group flow to the point where omega equals 1, which stops the Landau ghost, essentially. And this can be proven to all orders of perturbation theory. So now I have to conclude. I have to skip a lot of things, sorry. I won't talk about constructive theory at all and so on. So sorry for this. This is a lecture for a longer lecture. So I would like just to say that why am I interested to this, and what kind of inspiration can it give us for quantum gravity? So we would like to adapt the renormalization group to the models of quantum gravity, because we would like to understand what is the scale in these models. And that's going to be difficult, because these models are a priori diffeomorphism invariant, and therefore, a priori, there is no scale. But this is not correct, because in two or three dimensions, quantum gravity may be topological, but not in four. And in fact, there should be a notion of scale. But the problem is that that scale sort of might be given by a kind of external structure. But internally, there seems to be no scale. But there is a group formulation called the group field theory formulation. And then we could find a similarity with the Gross-Vulkenaar model in the matrix base. So we could try to see, is there a kind of exotic notion of scale? And is there a flow of parameters, like, for instance, Newton's constant, with respect to that flow? And it's not completely clear what is a physical interpretation, but I hope there is such a thing. OK, these are things that I don't want to talk about. But I would like to say, because of this fixed point and the fact that it should be a four-dimensional model that can be completely controlled, even non-perturbatively, I consider the Gross-Vulkenaar models as some kind of simple model of a new category, like I would like to call it the easing model of non-commutative field theory, because it's so nice. But OK, non-commutative field theory, I see it somehow as a structure intermediate in complexity between ordinary quantum field theory and the full difficulty of quantum gravity. And OK, 4D Moyal space is certainly just a toy. We don't want to keep it. We want to go to 3D or 4D gravity. And I feel that the discovery of this non-commutative renormalization group, it should make us bolder to look at what could be the proper notion of renormalization group in quantum gravity. So I'll stop here.
Other questions?
So.
So you wanted to propagate this term proportional to its view, and so that apparently breaks translation.
Yes, absolutely, that breaks translation.
So is it broken until the end? Or
yes, yes, it's broken until the end. Of course, if this omega parameter goes to zero, you recover the the other point of view. You can also find renormalizable theory in Moyer space which don't break your translation invariance. But I don't want to speak too much about them because they don't have this other very interesting feature, which is the fixed point. This fixed point of asymptotic safeness I like because it tells us that a certain rate, the rate of coupling stops its growth. And I think this is one feature that usually in ordinary field theory you cannot obtain except by invoking things like supersymmetry. So I think the symmetry between X and P could be a kind of possible alternative to supersymmetry. So that's why I like this model. But I don't like it as a kind of realistic model of the world. I like it just as a toy structure. Yes.
So you wrote down this non-commutative action principle with the Moyle star product.
And then
you treated it perturbatively. But
yes.
In the case of ordinary quantum field theories, another technique is to treat them by putting them on a lattice or some more form.
By lattice.
Lattice or some form of more explicit cutoff. Is there some work on?
There is no analog of lattice there because there's no analog of the non-commutative lattice there. But you have essentially. You can have several cutoffs, but essentially the best cutoff in this theory is a cutoff on the Schwinger representation of this propagator. In ordinary field theory, you have X space and P space. In non-commutative field theory, the X and P space are essentially the same, but you have the new one, which is a matrix base. In gravity, in loop gravity, you have the representation in terms of integrals over the group, or the representation in terms of representations, a kind of Fourier transform. So the Fourier transform looks more like the matrix base, because it's based on integers, and the group theory looks more like X space representation. But there is no real nice notion of lattices in these things. But wait a minute, there is a constructive theory for this, which is not based on lattice. And I can talk about that also.
I see. But I mean, it may not be so natural, but nevertheless, the star product is just some sort of non-local product.
Yes.
So why couldn't you put that on a lattice? You just think it wouldn't be neutral to do so?
Well, it would be extremely unnatural and ugly. It is not a problem of a gauge theory here. There's no gauge theory here. It would be very, very unnatural. But of course, the continuum space you can view always as the limit of a lattice, but it would not be a nice technical tool to do what we want to do. And, well, okay, yes.
If I may throw that in, I thought Andrian and Matvienko and others have constructed a non-commutative gauge theory on a lattice.
Gauge theory can be put on the lattice, but it cannot be constructively analyzed from the lattice, until now at least.
No, I mean non-commutative.
This
question was about
What about non-commutative field theory, gauge field theory? Okay, that's a very important topic. This model is not a gauge theory, but we could do the same thing for a gauge theory and ask what happens. And this is the object of active research, and the conclusion is unclear. This is one of the topics that I say require absolutely new investigation. If you take the Young-Mills theory and you do replace the ordinary product by star products, you obtain something which has ultraviolet and infrared mixing. So it is not renormalizable in the ordinary sense, certainly. Then you can say, why not do the same trick as Grossman-Kuna? Instead of having commutators of the ANU with ANU, we should add their Langevin-Szabo dual, which we know are anti-commutators, and we should look at this thing. The problem is that then you get non-trivial vacua. Okay, this is related somehow to the Higgs mechanism. But we don't, because we have non-trivial vacua, we don't have yet a theorem that this vulcanized gauge theory, we call it vulcanized because of Vulcanar, but this is a nickname. This theory, we have no proof yet that it is renormalizable. But it might be, but we have no proof yet. So the subject of whether there are non-commutative Young-Mills theory which are renormalizable is still open. We have no example, no proofs. We have proofs, but no proof.
Two issues.
Yes.
If you formulate the relativity filters.
Yeah.
Use a Moyano's product.
Yeah.
The metric is complex.
There's a metric.
If this is not a problem with the unknown, also, if you ignore this problem, which is spent around your fixed background doing a tough problem of gravity, the theory is not even wise.
Yes.
So I'm not convinced that one has made any progress.
Yes, okay. So in a loop quantum gravity or in this kind of theories, the problem is you don't have, sort of you don't have ultraviolet infinities, but you may have infrared infinities. For instance, if you formulate them in terms of some of our representations, of you have integers that go up to infinity, but they start from zero, just like here. So there is a problem with the sum going up to infinity, and we don't know yet exactly to analyze this problem. It's harder. The notion of loops and so on is more entangled because the vertices are much more complicated in group theory.
Do you find that the non-planar graphs in the gravitons?
Yes.
It can oscillate finite. The planar graph is still positive dimension.
Yeah. I think in the year 2000 when Zeiberg and Armstrong and found this ultraviolet infrared mixing, then it was not clear at all that this theory could be renormalized. And I think I'm not convinced that quantum gravity cannot be renormalized. But we'll see.
Can I ask a non-expert, a very non-expert, because this is an expert, so from a distance, I have a feeling that the following things happen. This infrared ultraviolet mixing, which somehow says that going very big is like going very small.
Yes.
Started off in this work as a bug, then it became a feature,
yes.
And now you're making a principle.
almost, yes. There are people who go even further. They can base on it a kind of effective theory of gravity, like Steinacker or like that. I won't discuss this. But no, I make it as a source of inspiration of the fact that the renormalization group might be more exotic and might be different. When you see it in group field theory, the picture of what happens is quite abstract. You know, these representations over spins and so on are very far from physical intuition of what you observe. So I have to say, I think that we might be open for, you know, when you try to denormalize quantum gravity, you try to add local objects of higher terms compared to the Einstein interaction. Here you don't do that at all. So if you, what I'm looking for is rather, if you have a large sequence of scales in the universe, and maybe Neil could explain us why there is a large sequence of scales. Maybe, yeah, okay, that's another problem, why the universe is big. So he might explain us that. But at least certainly it is very big compared to the Planck length, and I am very surprised that it is so big. So, I mean, there is room for, it's like the Avogadro number is big, it's not infinity, but you use thermodynamic limits, and that's very important mathematically. So I think we have to understand if really things from quantum gravity, like parameters like the Newton constants, evolve or not, even if there is not an infinite number of scales, but just a finite one. And we have to cut the theory into scales, because the main lesson of Wilson is renormalization group is too difficult, like a trajectory in mechanics of a non-integrable system, it's too difficult to be computed at once. You have to compute it in two steps. And I think this is not sufficiently realized sometimes by quantum field theorist people, that we have to do renormalization in steps, not just at once. And then maybe we have to see what kind of dynamics this gives. And I think this is, in the formalism of group field theory, this has not been really explored now. So in that sense, we might find an interesting kind of renormalization group. And it may have very little to do with the initial question of whether by adding, which we know is not correct, by adding local terms to the Einstein interaction, do we get something renormalizable? That's another thing.
Very good. Last quick question.
Yeah, so this is a very technical question again, but I'll try and put it in a kind of principled form. I'm interested very in the relationship between non-locality in the Lorentzian signature, the Minkowski signature, and in the Euclidean signature. One reason for my own interest is because causal sets introduce a radical non-locality in the Lorentzian, that is, discreteness plus Lorentz invariance implies a kind of radical non-locality. So the general question is, can you relate this to, answer partly John's question, relate this to the Lorentzian signature? Mm. In particular, is there any analog of the is there any analog of the Osterwalder-Schrader construction?
Is there any analog of
Osterwalder-Schrader construction?
Yeah. Okay. There's currently work by, for instance, by Rosser and other people on this issue. There is a kind of a weaker form called wedge locality. And well, I am not working very. I cannot say much about this. There is a, if you maintain strict causality within the framework of the star product, then you might not have ultraviolet infrared mixing. That was discovered by the Dorothea Bands. But I'm not so sure this phenomenon is so important, because I don't think if you violate locality, I don't see why you should keep strict causality in a sense. You can also do the following, but I don't like to say this is an answer either. So the short answer to your question is, for the moment, no. There is no clear Osterwalder-Schrader analog of the axioms. But you can do the following. Well, there is an analog if you do the star product only on the sort of external legs and keep the internal vertices local. But I don't like this at all. So for the real question, it's basically open. For your constructive question about whether this constructive theory is related to functional integrals or not, I would say if I start speaking on this, I will speak for a day. So the only thing, if you are really interested into that, is to come for private discussion. I can tell you why we can do constructive theory without functional integrals, just by summing graphs, no functional integrals at all.
So luckily, the sun is with us for more than 24 hours more. Okay. I think till the weekend, so we have lots of time for discussion, and thank you very much for a beautiful talk.